by Joe Bonney with original music by Amy Mann and choreography by Sonia Taya. Begins May 13th. More at publictheater.org.
Frontline Voices. I'm the host of the show on Fridays, Rebecca Miles. On the show today, we'll hear from Lawrence Sam, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, on the counter-protest march against Trump dictatorship as the president celebrates himself under the guise of the 250th anniversary of the founding of the US Republic. Later, we'll hear from Caleb Maupin on Trump's prevarication over fighting Iran or making a deal with Iran. And if we have time, an update on Lebanon. But first, some news headlines. US President Donald Trump says he's called off airstrikes on Iran because a peace deal is close to being agreed on and a time and a place of signing to be announced shortly. Trump is under enormous pressure to reach a deal with Iran over the price of oil, which is rapidly going back and forth with every announcement. Each rise in price of oil translates into higher gasoline prices, and Trump has promised to bring the costs of goods and services down in the US. Recent inflation numbers show those prices are continuing to rise. The consumer price index rose at an annual rate of 4.2% in May. Energy prices accounted for more than 60% of the monthly increase, driven by the US-Israeli war on Iran, which has disrupted oil supplies through the Strait of Hormuz. Gas prices are now up more than 40% compared to a year ago. Iran's foreign ministry says, however, the main part of the text was almost finalized, but the Americans are being greedy and raising new requests. Iran's IRNA news agency says during a 60-day period, Washington and Tehran will work on negotiations aimed at addressing and resolving three outstanding issues not addressed in the current memorandum of understanding. Quote, the three issues are to the continuation of a peaceful nuclear program, lifting of sanctions, and a mechanism for compensating losses, end quote. Final negotiations will not begin before the release of half of Iran's frozen funds and the suspension of oil sanctions. Iranian media says any deal with the U.S. must obligate Israel to end the war in Lebanon. Iran says it will not surrender its control over the Strait of Hormuz in any peace deal with the United States until the war is deemed to be over. quote, contrary to what is being circulated by Western media, Iran will not commit to relinquishing control of the Strait of Hormuz. The only matter referred to in the memorandum of understanding is the return of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz after the end of the war, Iran's state media reported, adding, the main objective of signing the memorandum of understanding is to end the war on all fronts. Earlier, Trump warned Iran would be hit very hard and threatened US forces would take Kark Island and other oil infrastructure. In Lebanon, attacks have killed 3,711 people, with 11,843 wounded as Israel's army continues its deadly bombardment and occupations of southern Lebanon. In New York, New York State Governor Kathy Hochul has called on President Trump and the border czar Tom Homan to reconsider deploying a surge of federal immigration officers to New York during the FIFA World Cup, calling it a recipe for chaos and disruption. Hochul signed new laws earlier this month to prevent NYPD and other law enforcement agencies from cooperating with ICE, banning ICE agents from making arrests in schools and houses of worship and at healthcare facilities, and banning ICE agents from wearing masks. Hochul framed the package as a way to protect New Yorkers from federal overreach. And yesterday, residents from the Fulton and Elliott Chelsea houses, which span six blocks in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan, were in appeals court to discuss the latest on I'll have this interview just now with Leila Law-Gasico, journalist and community advocate with Chelsea's Fulton and Elliott Chelsea houses. Start with where things are currently before we go into what happened in court yesterday. Just for listeners who are not familiar, this is there was a redevelopment plan for Chelsea's Fulton and Elliott Chelsea houses, which is now in a sort of state of limbo because of a state appeals court temporary restraining order. So just explain in a snapshot, if you would, where things are and what the plan was and where things are now.
Yeah, sure. So initially, the plan was to rehabilitate all the buildings at Fulton and Elliott Chelsea, and then a bait and switch came up, and we later decided that they would tear down all the buildings, 24 of them, and redevelop the entire site, which is 5 acres, with very tall towers, and it would segregate the tenants into six of those towers, and the rest would be market rate luxury and affordable housing. Right now, because the tenants and the broader Chelsea community have organized, a number of lawsuits were filed, and there was the Court of Appeals made the decision to issue a temporary restraining order. So right now, NYCHA related and HUD actually cannot do anything until the courts issue a decision on the case, and you know the court cases go through all the different appeals that are available.
And so the temporary restraining order pauses this $1.2 billion redevelopment plan. So
Let me just correct your number, if I may.
Yes.
We have actually found out through our financing documents that the project now is estimated to be at $2.4 billion.
Right. That's quite a difference. Double, essentially. So what, with this temporary restraining order, what happened in, you were in the appeals court yesterday, what happened?
Yes, that's right. So yesterday, the lawyers argued in oral arguments in front of a panel of judges of the appellate division why NYCHA actions are actually unlawful. And you know, the as always, you know, arguments are actually pretty technical and you know, rooted in the law. We feel really good because you know, it is pretty clear, the law is pretty clear that, you know, NYCHA does not have the authority to privatize the land, to give the land away to private developers for market rate housing, and doesn't have the right to do this big land grab.
And what happens now with the judges go off and decide on this and make a decision on this?
Yes, that's right. So the temporary restraining order stays in place. So right now, NYCHA and related and all their subcontractors are not allowed to harass tenants, not allowed to bother them, pressure them, coerce them into moving or signing any Section 8 privatized lease. And then we're just waiting for the judges of the Court of Appeal to issue their decision.
And do you know when that might happen?
It's really hard to tell. You know, it could be quick and swift. It could take weeks, it could take months. You know, we don't really know.
Right. And what about the argument that this sort of comes at a time when there's desperate need for more housing and the footprint of the Chelsea Fulton Elliott Chelsea houses would allow for the creation of additional housing. What about that argument?
You know, listen, I think that we all understand and appreciate that there is a housing crisis, but let's define this a little bit more clearly. There is an affordable housing crisis. So, you know, bringing market rate luxury housing is not going to solve anything. There are plenty of vacant sites in the district. Let's take, for example, Hudson Yards. Phase two, Related has applied for a permit that would facilitate the construction of 4,000 units. And you know what? Out of those 4,000, only 600 would be affordable. How about we ex exert pressure there so that we get more affordable housing over there in a place that is entirely undeveloped, rather than trying to cram more housing on a campus that has, you know, historically existed, that is you know, a really, really important part of the urban landscape of Chelsea, and that does not really allow for much more construction. It is already very, very dense, and you know, it's an area where there's not a lot of open space. So let's not think that, you know, we can cram more construction of luxury housing when we have, you know, another 10 acres available 10 blocks north.
Right. Okay, I think we'll leave it there unless there's something else you'd like to add.
You know, I would just like to say that, you know, right now there is, you know, budget negotiations are ongoing with the City Council. We found out that there is $1.5 billion in the current budget, in the executive budget, that would be earmarked for the PACT conversion, meaning for privatization of public housing. This is hard dollars that would go in the pockets of developers to sweeten the deals of privatization. So we are arguing that, you know, these dollars that are already committed should actually be reallocated and committed to fixing and improving Section 9 housing. We hear the argument all the time, there's no funding, there's no funding. Well, here is your funding, 1.5 billion. It is a real number that would actually do a lot of good for public housing. And we are advocating that the City Council makes a decision, they have final say, to actually reallocate these funds to support public housing so that we can keep public housing public.
Now, the executive budget is in the final round of discussions. Where is the City Council on that proposal?
So, we know that a number of council members are, very receptive to this argument. I think that people are starting to realize that, this Section 8 conversion is actually not necessarily good long term. Seeing an opportunity to actually solve the problem rather than, bringing a problem, we are, telling the council that, this is how you can solve it by basically reallocating funding that already is committed in the budget. So that has a lot of appeal, and we're going to continue to make our case. Council has final say on budget matters, and we feel very positive about an outcome that would really support Section 9 public housing.
Okay, Leila, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on the show this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.
And that was Leila Law-Gossico, who's the journalist and community advocate with Chelsea Fulton and Elliot Chelsea Public Housing. It's been an ongoing fight between developers and a bait and switch, as Leila was talking about, trying to move public housing into a private development deal. The case is the lawsuit is winding its way through appeals. We'll follow up with this story when we hear what happens with the judge's decision. Joining me now is Lawrence Ham, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, to talk about a march against Trump dictatorship that's happening in Newark, New Jersey on Sunday, June 14th. Welcome to the show, Lawrence.
Good afternoon, Rebecca. It's good to be here with you.
So, you've planned this march while in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, where anybody who's interested will be watching the Ultimate Fighting Championship on the White House lawn. It will mark Trump's 80th birthday and Flag Day, and it's being titled UFC Freedom 250. There's a custom-built 4,000-seat arena and weigh-ins at the Lincoln Memorial. In response to that, you are organizing this march against the Trump dictatorship in Newark, New Jersey. Why are you doing this?
We're having this march because we want to protest this sham celebration by the Trump administration. This has really nothing to do with anything more than a celebration of Donald Trump. That's what this is. And also propagation of a white supremacist narrative of American history. This celebration, first of all, it's blatant hypocrisy, and it's a disgrace. I mean, this is how you celebrate the birth of the United States with a UFC gladiatorial contest. I mean, this is how Trump sees himself. He sees himself as an emperor, as a he's perhaps our 21st century Caligula. And we're also having this protest in alignment with the protest, the No Kings protest that will take place across the country. You can remember last year, June 14th, 2025, there were several thousand protests across the United States in towns and cities across the United States, No Kings protest. And so we're also in alignment with the No Kings protest that will be taking place across the country. And we will be protesting Trump's racist, fascist, and draconian policies at home, and his imperialistic and oppressive policies, his imperialistic wars and oppressive policies abroad.
Right. If we could drill down into that a little bit, specific actions or policies that have led you to characterize his administration as a dictatorship. I mean, of course, in Newark, you're right in the current front lines of the effects of his immigration program, where he's housed dozens of people in Delaney Hall, and it's been the site of protest certainly over a year, but it stepped up once food and a hunger strike and a labour strike took place inside the facility. What other actions have you that you've been particularly sort of that you affixed to this would-be dictator?
Well, of course, we will be raising the issue of Delaney Hall. We've been in league with the organizations that have been down there for more than 18 months. The Eyes on ICE Coalition and the ICE Out of New Jersey Coalition and Pax Christi and New Jersey Immigrant Alliance for Justice, Make the Road, Resistencia, and all the others. There are many organizations that have been protest. They were protesting before Delaney Hall was even open. They were protesting the fact that the county was going to lease this facility to Geo Corporation to, in essence, open a private prison. And they were protesting then. And once it got open, they were protesting. And we joined them to demand the closure of Delaney Hall. As you remember, Mayor Baraka got arrested May 9th. Congresswoman MacGyver, Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman, Congressman Menendez were there also when Mayor Baraka was arrested. The charges against Baraka were dropped, but however, the U.S. Trump's U.S. attorney for New Jersey levied charges against Congresswoman Monica MacGyver, and I believe her trial may begin toward the end of the month. She convicted on the charges that the Trump administration has brought against her. She could possibly face a 17-year prison term. So, of course, we're raising that issue. We're raising the war on Black people that the administration has been waging. Probably the most blatant example of that has been the attack on voting rights and on the voter suppression tactics that the Trump administration has been engaged in. The Supreme Court decision in the Louisiana versus Calais case, which has in essence gutted and eviscerated, all but eliminated in name, the Voting Rights Act. That's one of the things that spurred us to hold a protest at the federal courthouse and this protest on the 14th. But there are certainly many more Trump administration policies that have adversely affected the Black community. How could we leave out the war in Iran, you know, which is costing billions of dollars every day? Trump said this war would be over in 3 and 4 weeks, and now we're almost at month number four with no end in sight, and it costing billions. And of course, his threatening to invade Cuba, the blockade that is literally strangling to death Cuban people, one of the most inhumane foreign policy initiatives this government has undertaken, as well as the kidnapping of President Maduro, as well as American intervention all over the continent of Africa. So we're going to be looking at these policies at home, policies abroad. Look, just last night, I believe, or what's today, the 11th, last week, they passed the budget initiative, which has gone into effect, cut almost $1 trillion from Medicaid. Hospitals all over the country are going to be closing, have closed. In New Jersey, 12 hospitals are threatened with closure. So this administration is immiserating the lives of people all across this country. And that's why we're going to be protesting on Sunday. We should not be celebrating a dictator. Mm-hmm. We should not be celebrating a dictator. We should not be celebrating a racist interpretation of history that serves empire. We should be protesting it.
And the march will end at the Martin Luther King Jr. statue in Newark. What significance does King's legacy have for this demonstration and the border movement that you're building?
Yes, the protests will begin, will take place on Sunday, June 14th at 2 o'clock p.m. We're going to gather at the Federal Building, 970 Broad Street in Newark. Now, we're gathering there because that's the foremost symbol of federal power, the power of the United States federal government in Newark, New Jersey. The office of the United States Attorney for New Jersey is there. The office for ICE is there in the Federal Building. So we're going to start there. We're going to rally there. And if weather and other conditions permit, we're going to march from the Federal Building on Broad Street up to the Martin Luther King statue on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Newark. And the reason we're going to the King Monument is because Dr. King had laid out a program toward the end of his life, a program to protest racial injustice and inequality, but also economic injustice and inequality. It was also an agenda for peace. Remember, at the end of his life, Dr. King was being excoriated in the media for opposing the United States war in Vietnam. And I believe if Dr. King were alive today, he would be protesting and opposing Trump's war in Iran and these other wars going on. He would be standing up for justice for the Palestinian people, which is another issue we're going to raise at our rally, the ongoing genocide against the Palestinians and the Zionist war against Lebanon and the other states surrounding Israel. So we're ending with Dr. King because he is symbolic of the movement for resistance at home and abroad.
If you could create your own celebration of the nation's 250th anniversary, what would that look like?
Well, it would look much different. It would look much different from the one. There would be no UFC gladiatorial arena on the lawn of the White House, that's for sure. First of all, it would be multiracial, intergenerational, as broad as possible appeal, and it would reflect the histories and contributions of all the people of the United States. I mean, this celebration that Trump is perpetrating, he doesn't talk about the genocide against the indigenous people here in North and South America, the theft of their land. He doesn't talk about the enslavement of Africans and the theft of their labor. He doesn't talk about the ongoing apartheid system that existed. It continues to exist in the United States since the end of the Civil War and this 60-year attempt to roll back everything that was gained during the civil rights and Black Power movements. It would talk about the struggle of labor. It would talk about the struggle of women. It would talk about the struggle for Puerto Rican independence and the struggle of our Chicano brothers and sisters in the West. It would talk about the struggle of gay people and their contributions to American culture. It would be all inclusive, and it would talk about how we have to change this country so this country can be a country in which all people can prosper, live together in harmony, and develop to the fullest extent their human potential, not this exploitative and oppressive nightmare that Donald Trump will be engaging in on the 4th of June 14th.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Ham, that's all we've got time for this afternoon. I'm sorry, but thank you very much for joining us on Frontline Voices.
Thank you, Rebecca. Take care.
Thank you. That was Lawrence Ham, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, who's organizing a march against Trump dictatorship in Newark, New Jersey on Sunday, June 14th, a counter protest in response to Trump's administration celebrating in Washington, D.C. That start at 2 p.m. at the Rodino Federal Building at 970 Broad Street in Newark and end at the Martin Luther King statue. We'll just take a short musical break and then be back with our next guest this afternoon, Caleb Maupin, on Trump's prevarication over fighting Iran or making a deal with Iran. And we'll be back with you shortly. Joining me now is Caleb Maupin, investigative journalist and founder of the Center for Political Innovation, to talk about Trump's prevarication over fighting Iran or making a deal with Iran. Welcome to the show, Caleb.
Sure thing. Glad to be here.
So, on Thursday, we hear this announcement from the from President Trump that he's canceled the strike on Iran. And he said, based on the fact that discussions with the Islamic Republic of Iran have been brought to the highest level of Iranian leadership and approved, I have, as President of the United States of America, canceled the scheduled strikes and bombings against Iran this evening. Discussions and final points have been, in both concept and great detail, approved by all parties involved. And Trump wrote that on Truth Social. But hours earlier, Trump had threatened to escalate the conflict by targeting Karg Island and other oil facilities after bombing two reservoirs, leaving 20,000 people in Iran without a water supply. And then Trump later told reporters at the White House, "We've just made a great settlement with the war with Iran. The strait will officially open as soon as we sign, which could be soon, very soon, maybe over the weekend in Europe." But of course he's made claims of an imminent deal nearly 40 times since the initial ceasefire deal was signed on April 7th. What do you make of this backwards and forwards prevarication? What do you make of it, Caleb?
Well, I must say this is the 39th or 40th time that we've had Trump say that we're on the verge of a deal with Iran. So that makes me feel like I'm very hesitant to believe that we're actually going to get a deal. However, we do have the Iranian foreign ministry saying that a deal has never been closer, which is surprising. Now, the White House, their claim is that the deal is that Iran will get a number of its assets that have been frozen around the world. And in exchange for that, that Iran will stop supporting what they call terrorist groups throughout the region. And the Strait of Hormuz will be opened. Now, Iran has said there are certain red lines that they will not cross, and the spokesperson for Hezbollah has said that they are confident that Iran will not agree to stop supporting them and that they will be protected in the deal, and that the Iranian foreign ministry has said what the USA does is it says it's about to make a deal and then it starts backtracking. Now, a version of the deal was leaked to the media, and Donald Trump got very defensive today and said that was not a real, that text was not real, and that's not what the deal is actually going to say, and this is the fake news media. So honestly, I don't know what to believe. I'll just tell you. My predisposition was to believe what, was said by Joe Kent and others, that a deal with Iran is very, very unlikely, and that Trump is, you know, his best move is to just kind of withdraw from the region, because I don't think America will ever sign an agreement that allows Iran to keep supporting its neighbors. And I don't think Iran will stop supporting its, you know, its political and regional allies in the axis of resistance. And Iran has said that a deal is very close, apparently, but they've also said that that they will not be, you know, cutting off their support to their regional allies. So I don't know what to believe.
Right. I mean, even within, you know, the foreign ministry spokesman, Esmail Baki, said on Thursday the text is almost finalized in major parts. But the problem is that the contradictory positions of the United States have always caused turbulence and disruption in the process. I mean, of course, if we go back to the 12-day war, they were in the middle of discussion there over a deal, and then suddenly they're in the middle of a 12-day war where Israel and the U.S. attacked Iran. But do you know the details of the memorandum of understanding? Do you know what some of the points were that were made?
Well, that remains in question. If you look at the agreement, I mean, there is an understanding that the Strait of Hormuz will be opened, but we're recognizing that it is territorial waters between Iran and Oman. There is an understanding that Iran will get, you know, the USA has stolen billions of dollars from Iran, right? Iran is a country just like any other. It's a member of the United Nations, a member state, and, you know, it has to have money in different countries. And the USA has this policy of going around the world and figuring out where Iran has, you know, got its money and just freezing it. And, you know, billions and billions of Iranian dollars are frozen in bank accounts around the world that the United States has decided they want to shut down. And the idea is that Iran will get access to their own money. That will be part of the agreement. And that similar things were done with the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, that was passed during the Obama administration. But as far as Iran's support for its regional allies, that seems to be the primary question, because, you know, the axis of resistance, that is the term that was used. It was kind of a response to the term axis of evil. When George W. Bush referred to Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as the axis of evil, it was around 2006, a couple of years later, when Hezbollah defeated the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and delivered a very, very epic defeat to Israel in 2006, in July, you know, after the Israeli invasion. It was then that Iran and its allies started calling themselves the axis of resistance. And we're not the axis of evil, we're the axis of resistance in the region. And that term has become more and more popular. And the term axis of resistance, describing Hezbollah in Lebanon, describing Ansar Allah, the Houthis in Yemen, describing various groups in Iraq that are supported by Iran, Shia militias, describing the Bahrain Popular Democratic Movement that opposes the Saudi-imposed monarch on Bahrain. You know, Bahrain is not a democracy. They have an imposed Saudi king, and they have a majority of the population are Shia Muslims, but the Saudis impose a Sunni monarch on them. All those forces have called themselves the Axis of Resistance, and they are this kind of anti-imperialist movement aligned with Iran, centered around Shia Islam, though many of the forces aligned with them or involved with them are not Shia. You know, Hezbollah has prominent Christian members, prominent Sunni members in Lebanon. You know, there are people in Bahrain that advocate democracy that are not Shia Muslims, that are Sunnis, but they want to elect their leader. They don't want to have a king imposed on them by Saudi Arabia. And, you know, in Syria, the majority of the forces that fought alongside the Islamic Revolutionary Guards of Iran defend the Syrian Arab Republic were Sunni Muslims. There were also Christian militias. There were, you know, Marxist groups and others. So it's not purely a religious movement, but Iran's government is a Shia Muslim government based on the Shia Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979. And the forces around the region that align with them generally call themselves the Axis of Resistance. And it's a very vast movement. I mean, there's a number of different groups aligned with it. I mean, we're talking about millions of people here. The idea is that Iran would stop leading and giving support to this movement throughout the region. They're not going to do that. That would be suicide for them. They would be losing any support they have in the region and any ability to defend themselves. I mean, it's largely been these forces fighting, you know, in support of Iran that have enabled Iran to, you know, repel the attacks. So, I mean, I don't think Iran is going to stop supporting those forces. I don't think the White House is ever going to say they have the right to support those forces. And so that's why I've been feeling that a deal is very, very unlikely. But I guess the Iranian foreign ministry is saying it's never been closer. Trump is saying it's close. He said that, 40, 39 times before at least. So we'll see.
And what about earlier in the week? Well, earlier in the week, of course, the thousands of Iranians in the southern port of the town of Sirik had lost access to drinking water after U.S. strikes hit two reservations in the area. And then the U.S. carried out strikes on the southern cities of Jask and Sirik and on Keshem Island and the Strait of Hormuz. And then Trump was proposing to... discuss the possibility of taking Kark Island. What would a seizure of another country's oil infrastructure mean? Would that be considered a war crime or what?
Well, I mean, it would have an impact on the oil markets, and that's the thing. The oil markets are already going through the roof, and Kark Island is strategically located. It's where a lot of Iranian oil infrastructure is based. And it would be considered theft. I mean, it would be an illegal violation of Iran's territorial integrity. It would be the use of force. It'd be a violation of the UN Charter. But the United States doesn't seem to be opposed to that kind of thing. I mean, this totally unprovoked war there was no provocation. There was no justification for this attack on Iran. Iran was never going to get a nuclear weapon. They were not found to be in violation of the International Atomic Energy Agency or the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have not taken any steps toward getting a bomb that they don't have the right to take. They have the right to enrich their own uranium, et cetera. There was no provocation for this whatsoever. It was a completely unprovoked conflict. Now, I've been to southern Iran, to Bandar Abbas. I was there in 2015 when I participated in a humanitarian mission that tried to deliver medical aid to Yemen. And so I've been in this area, in Bandar Abbas, and I was in the Gulf of Aden and all the way up into the Red Sea in the port of Hodeidah, near Hodeidah in Yemen. And so this area that is highly, contested and, part of the conflict, I've seen it with my own eyes. What struck me in 2015 when I was in Bandar Abbas was how much Chinese freight there is. I mean, this is a port city in southern Iran where a lot of the oil deals, a lot of the oil tankers come in and such. But when I was there, it was just so many ships and so many businesses with Chinese language, Chinese characters, Chinese corporations. It seems like Iran and China are very, very close. And that's what I observed when I was in Bandar Abbas in 2015. And I'm sure that's even more the case since the failure of the Iran nuclear deal. Since Iran has joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that Iran and China are extremely close. China gets a lot of oil from Iran, and Iran, and Saudi Arabia restored their diplomatic relations because of Beijing's efforts to bring them together. And even now, as Saudi Arabia is passively and in some cases openly supporting the U.S. attacks on Iran, Iran and Saudi Arabia still maintain a diplomatic relationship, largely based on the fact that China buys oil from both of them. The oil prices are rising, though, and the danger of the Red Sea, and the Strait of Bab al-Mandab being closed by the Ansar Allah Houthis, that is the threat that's hanging over Trump's head. And if that happens, we're looking at the end of the U.S. economy is already screaming. Trump is just losing badly in the polls. The population of America cannot stand these prices. If the Strait of Bab al-Mandab is closed by the Houthis, at that point, the United States will have to go in and clear out the Strait of Bab al-Mandab. And every time the USA has been prepared to actually go head-to-head with the Houthis, the USA backs down. We saw that with the Biden administration when they bombed Yemen a couple times, and then they backed down. We saw that with Trump when he sent, the battleships and the airstrike, the aircraft carriers to the Red Sea, and then he pulled them out very quickly and said, okay, the Houthis can block Israeli ships, they can't block other ships. The USA is really scared to go head-to-head with the Houthis because they have so much support among the population, because of the fact that they are in the mountainous regions of Yemen, of northern Yemen, that are very hard terrain to fight a war in. They have them locked down and prepared and loaded, and they've got lots of drones to attack ships with, and that the USA really just doesn't want to go head-to-head with the Houthis because there would be a massive casualty rate on the American side. And there's no way around that. And that would be bad for any administration to have a number of U.S. soldiers killed. And if the Houthis close the Strait of Bab el-Mandab, the USA will have to move its forces into the Red Sea to clear it out. And that will come at a heavy cost in terms of American lives. And that is what Trump is really afraid of. It's really the Houthis that are the deciding force here. And if there is a deal, you can thank Ansar Allah and the Houthis for it.
Right. We also heard this week that inflation numbers have gone up to 4.2%, and energy prices account for 60% of the monthly increase, and gas prices are now up 40% compared to a year ago. What are you hearing from Americans about dealing with these gas prices?
I mean, the poll numbers speak for themselves. I mean, Trump is wildly unpopular. The war is wildly unpopular. Numbers of opposition to the war are massive. I mean, the public doesn't like having to pay the economic cost of a war that was completely unprovoked. I mean, there was no justification for this. Iran was not moving toward getting a nuclear weapon in any way. Anything that they were not permitted to do under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they were not found to be in violation at all. That's the situation. So the public isn't buying the arguments for the war. The Trump camp is not buying the arguments for the war. The Democrat public is largely opposed. I mean, this war is not popular. It's not supported. And people are, Graham Plattner, won the primary in Maine, despite a lot of opposition to him in the press, pounding the podium against this war as a veteran. Poll after poll shows the American people are not for this, and Trump is having to explain his support for this conflict to a base that doesn't want to hear it.
Right. So you'll suspect we're not going to see a deal signed this weekend. I'm not sure how he can while he's also celebrating his 80th birthday, and he's got this big event on the White House lawn. What do you think we might see over the weekend, where it seems that both Israel and the U.S. tend to carry out significant bombings and attacks? And where might we be on Monday, for instance?
Well, that's the thing. If this follows the pattern of before, every time it seems like we're close to a deal, that's when the USA or Israel attacks Iran or escalates in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. So that would fit the pattern if that were what was happening, if that was to happen. But if there is actually to be a deal and the Strait of Hormuz opened, there would be certainly, economic relief at that point. And the sad thing is there's something called Polymarket. There's a website where people are betting on this, and people with inside information are making money off of this. And that's the underlying aspect of this conflict that is just so cynical, is that, that people in the administration are betting money on what they know will happen. With inside information, there's been investigations, and I mean, it's just so cynical when Trump announced he wanted to expand the U.S. military budget a couple days beforehand, Pete Hegseth, head of the Department of War, previously known as the Department of Defense, bought a whole bunch of stock in U.S. military defense corporations because he knew that Trump calling for that would make their stocks go up, and that there is an element of just kind of cynical playing the market by forces that know what the results are going to be ahead of time and are betting on it and are making money throughout the whole process. And Marjorie Taylor Greene has called this out. AOC has called this out. This is just—it's just cynical. They're playing these kind of games with, well, the Strait of Hormuz might be open this weekend, but will it? Will it be open? And they'll know before the public knows, and they'll bet money on what happens. And I mean, this is so unfortunate. I mean, this has kind of been turned into a stock market and poly market game for these people connected to the administration. And the more twists and turns and unexpected outcomes this has, the more money they make. It's unfortunate.
Mm. Caleb Maupin, thank you for coming on the show today.
Sure thing.
That was Caleb Maupin, journalist and founder of the Center for Political Innovation, on Trump's prevarication over fighting Iran or making a deal with Iran. And we just touched a little bit on what's happening with Lebanon, which I'm sure there'll be more attacks this weekend, a continuation of attacks and more death and more wounding and more displacement, ethnic displacement. I want to thank Catherine Davis and Reggie Johnson for engineering today. Carrie McDade, Gianna Perez and Sal Tazinski are our WBAI News intern reporters. You can find archives of the show on the website at www.wbai.org, and you can find their stories on the website. If you value this type of programming, please consider making a donation to the station or becoming a WBAI buddy, a monthly subscription. You set the terms to support programming in the future of the station. We are in the middle of a soft fundraising drive. The goal is significant, $170,000. Our tower rent is $17,000 a month with the Durst Corporation. And it's a hefty bill, but we need your help, as always, a support for independent radio. Please call 833-922-4692. That's 833-WBAI-NYC. If no one answers the phone, please leave a message on your phone, message with your phone number, and we'll call you back. Or you can send a check to made out to WBAI Pacifica Radio, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Thank you for listening and supporting WBAI Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM in New York. I'll be back on Monday at 12 noon with more Frontline Voices. Next up is Arnie Arniston with The Attitude. And don't miss Randy Credico with Live on the Fly at 3 p.m. for more of his radio alchemy. Thank you. I'm Rebecca Miles, and this is Frontline Voices.
And this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. All right, folks, we got a little bit of time here. That means that I'm going to go to independent journalist Caitlin Johnstone being read by Tim Foley. And this one is called AI Won't Save Us from the Need to End Capitalism. So here we go.
Us from the need to end capitalism. One reason AI is being pushed so hard is because it's the last humanity can capitalism its way out of all its problems narrative that has yet to be fully discredited. The idea is that if we can just create AI gods and let them come up with the effective yet profitable innovative technological solutions to our various existential crises that our own fleshy brains have so far failed to produce, then we don't need to dismantle the socioeconomic system we built that is destroying our biosphere and driving us to our doom. Embedded in this logic is the same baseless assumption that has been plaguing us this entire time, that there are effective yet profitable solutions to be found, that we can simply let the free market deliver us desirable products that will both A, cause us to stop cannibalizing our ecosystem, and B, create billionaires and trillionaires. Capitalism hasn't provided any innovations that have allowed us to consume our way out of our problems thus far, but because we've got these complex new AI technologies now, we can allow ourselves to move this entirely faith-based assumption into the purview of our new gods. But that's just it. It's an assumption based on blind faith. There is no reason to believe we'll ever come up with technologies that are conducive to human and environmental thriving, which also happen to generate shareholder profits. Generally, profits are generated by producing and consuming more products, which is exactly what has gotten us into this mess in the first place. What this means is that capitalism has no ability to solve the problems we're coming up against as a species. There is no way to compete and consume our way out of the hole we dug through competition and consuming. We need new systems. Human behavior cannot continue to be driven by competition and the pursuit of profit. We need to move into collaboration with each other and with our biosphere if we are to survive into the future as a species. And we will be unable to do this if we are excluding all possible solutions that don't generate revenue for the capitalist class. AI is, for many people, just a psychological box that allows us to avoid facing this uncomfortable truth. Because, as Mark Fisher said, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. It's easier to imagine billionaire tech companies creating AI gods who will serve us up magical solutions to our urgent existential dilemmas, which also facilitate continued economic growth, than it is to imagine moving into collaboration-based systems where human behavior isn't driven by the pursuit of profit. But that's just a sign of how insane our species has become. It's a symptom of our collective madness. We need to wake up. We need to get real. It's adaptation or extinction time for us as a species. And that fork in the road is approaching very quickly.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. A key surveillance tool seen as vital to national security is set to expire after congressional efforts to temporarily extend it failed. Today's expiration would be a significant lapse for the law known as Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. It's unclear how soon lawmakers would be able to revive the spy program. That's even after President Trump said he'll nominate a new national intelligence director who's more palatable to both Republicans and Democrats than his initial pick, Bill Pulte. Still, there may not be an immediate drop-off given that a court order from March authorized these government surveillance powers to remain in effect for another year. President Trump is nominating Jay Clayton as Director of National Intelligence. Clayton is U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York and a former Securities and Exchange Commission chairman. Trump announced the nomination on social media Thursday amid pressure from Congress to name a permanent replacement for Tulsi Gabbard, who announced her resignation last month to care for her husband who's stricken with cancer.
Jay Clayton's an incredible talent, head of Sullivan & Cromwell. He was head of the SEC. He was now Southern District. I mean, nobody has better credentials.
Trump faced intense pushback over his decision to name Bill Pulte, head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, as acting director. The resulting uproar led to a standoff in Congress, as Democrats said they refused to renew foreign intelligence powers unless Trump pulled Pulte's nomination and named a permanent nominee. President Trump said today that the U.S. and Iran are close to an agreement to end the war in the Middle East. However, Iran has not yet confirmed any such deal. The announcement comes after the U.S. and Iran ramped up attacks this week near the Strait of Hormuz. Trump's statement did boost Asian markets today. Laura Westbrook reports from Hong Kong.
Asian stocks are rallying on the hopes the Middle East peace agreement may finally materialize after U.S. President Donald Trump said a deal to end the Iran war was close and may even be signed over the weekend. South Korea's Kospi surged around 8% on gains in chip-making stocks, while Japan's Nikkei 225 also jumped around 3.5% at one stage. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index was also benefiting from gains in local tech. Oil prices, meanwhile, fell to below $90 a barrel after the U.S. president said the Iran agreement will involve the immediate reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. Investors are also focusing on SpaceX's debut after raising $75 billion in the world's largest initial public offering. Laura Westbrook, Hong Kong.
The Food and Drug Administration has granted emergency approval for an over-the-counter treatment for the screwworm parasite in dogs and cats. This comes as health officials confirmed the first cases of screwworm in decades this week in cattle, a goat, and a dog in Texas and New Mexico. New World screwworm is a fly whose larvae feed on living tissue, entering animals through open wounds and burrowing into the flesh. The agency said fast-acting nitinpyram tablets can be used in pets weighing at least 2 pounds and at least 4 weeks old, adding that the drug is expected to help kill most larvae within hours of the first dose. Drugs may not protect against reinfestation, and veterinarians may still need to remove remaining larvae and treat wounds. U.S. officials have warned that while most pets in the country face low risk, animals that have recently been in affected areas were more vulnerable. Around 380,000 customers in Illinois and Indiana were without power, and air travel was disrupted by Thursday's severe storms. There were no immediate reports early today of deaths or life-threatening injuries from those storms. Tornado damage was reported in Indiana as well as in Illinois. Emergency crews were inspecting damage and assisting displaced residents. The storms also delayed flights in cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York. Severe weather.